You are listening to Radio Albion.
Welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson. And to the best of my knowledge, today is September 17th, 2023. Other than appealing for donations, as I always do, as I always need to do, unfortunately, a friend of mine just sent me a Skype announcing that there is now an encyclopedia on the Holocaust created by some of our people. It is a truly independent, uncensored encyclopedia. It's free, though, of course, not if you want the print edition or anything else. I strongly recommend you check it out. HolocaustEncyclopedia.com. Very simple. I've been reading pieces of it, and it's very, very well done. It's done in simple language, very easily accessible, nothing too long, unlike my stuff, and nothing in any kind of jargon. So for any of your debates on this essential topic, please go and check it out. And it is an essential topic. I tend to agree with Michael Hoffman. In fact, the very first revisionist I ever read was Michael Hoffman. And he said that the Jewish elite, Anti-Defamation League, and the rest want to replace the cross with what they very arrogantly call the Holocaust. 80 million people were killed in that war, all theaters, and yet this is all the significance they get from it, concerns what allegedly happened to their people. And as we all know, it was the Soviet Union that built a lot of these rumors, that in fact rebuilt parts of the concentration camps, which of course only refer to Jews, and it was the Soviets that, with the central force at the so-called Nuremberg hearings, which of course were a farce, that was not a trial, rules of evidence didn't exist, and the Soviets were at the center of that. There's always connections here. Back in 2019, if those of you who haven't bought it yet, please get your hands on it. My book, The Soviet Experiment, which was published by the Barnes Review and the Barnes Review Press, where I was the editor for a few years. I made several arguments in the introduction. I listed exactly what I was going to do. And one of the more important ones was that there was no connection between the Bolsheviks and any actual worker, any working class person. In fact, they had no understanding or interest in the working class. The Reds were ethnic in the sense that they were, at least in the early years, not completely Jewish, but at the elite levels, it was ridiculously top-heavy with them. But their agenda, if it had nothing to do with labor, and most certainly did not, it was something that the West had been wanting to do for a long time, destroy the Orthodox Church, to destroy old Russia. One of the main missions of this mostly Jewish Red takeover. When central planning was introduced, and it could only be done when the party had centralized power to itself. Central planning implies that the party controls all the wealth of the empire. In order to plan an economy, you have to be able to control the economy. And since law was, according to them, a bourgeois institution, which in and of itself is deceptive, it was their property and they profited massively from it. And of course, as we all know, the Western world, especially the United States, financed and really created the technical elements of the Soviet economy. In other words, there is a strongly religious element to the Bolshevik Revolution, which was a topic that white writers like Elin and so many others during the early part of the Soviet Union made reference to over and over again. The great author Tutchev, in my book on the Russian Orthodox idea and Russian literature, I have an essay on his. He wrote an article called Russia in Revolution in 1848, the revolutionary year. And he says, for a long time now in Europe, there have been only two real forces, the revolution and Russia. These two forces today stand against each other, and tomorrow maybe they'll fight each other. No agreement, no treaty is possible between them. The life of one means the death of the other. The entire political and religious future of mankind depends for centuries on the outcome of the struggle between them, the greatest struggle the world has ever seen. And unlike the establishment left that rules most of the planet right now, his prediction came true. And the key issue is that there is no room for discussion. But the concept of any negotiation, I mean, the left, wherever it has taken over, wherever it's taken over, from early modern Britain, France, to the USSR, to Hungary, to the Bavarian People's Republic, to the United States today, have destroyed any hope for that kind of debate. In fact, one of their weapons has been to confuse words and phrases and concepts that you would use there, perverting their meanings and changing them over time. The left, from then till now, I even say from the reign of Elizabeth I in Britain to today, the very existence of Russia has almost been an insult to revolution, whether it's a capitalist one or a Marxist one. And as we know, they have far more in common than they do separating them. Russia was an insult to the Jewish left, its very existence. And I'm going to continue with Tutchev, and he's talking about the struggle within Russia itself. And of course, again, this is the revolutionary year of 1848. He says, first of all, Russia is a Christian power, and the Russian people are Christian, not only because of the orthodoxy of their belief, but because of something even more sincere. Russia is such thanks to that ability for self-denial and self-sacrifice, which constitutes, as it were, the basis of his moral nature. Revolution is, first of all, the enemy of Christianity. The anti-Christian spirit is the soul of the revolution, its essential distinctive property, its consistently updated forms and slogans, violence and crimes. All these are particulars and random details, and it's this precisely anti-Christian principle that revives and vivifies her, which also, we have to admit, gives her a formidable power over the world. Anyone who does not understand this has been present for 60 years at the spectacle taking place in the world as a blind spectator. And we all know that there is a chronic abulia that interrupts people's understanding of what a revolution is. The U.S. over the last 60 years has been the victim of a violent, low-level violent form of revolution that really became utterly victorious in the last decade or so. But even Dostoevsky, and I think most of you are aware of this, again, I recommend that you go and get that book on my book on Russian literature, which I wrote about a million years ago. And it's because he wrote novels like Demons or The Possessed. In his Diary of a Writer, where most of his political stuff is found, he says a revolution must certainly begin with atheism. It had to overthrow the religion from which came the moral foundation of the society he denied and hated. It came out in 1873, so they were not talking about Bolshevism as such, but revolutionary movements have a lot in common. And that of capitalism, that of various forms of Marxism, are cut from the same cloth. And of course, the Jewish question, whether anyone likes it or not, is central. You can't talk about revolution, you can't talk about Russian history in this capacity without talking about the Jews. It makes you sound ridiculous if you're trying to do that. And he says in volume 30 of the Complete Works, a letter to Putkovich, 1878, he says, Odessa is a city of the Jews, turns out to be the center of our warring socialism. In Europe, the same phenomenon. The Jews are terribly involved in socialism. And I'm not even talking about LaSalle, Karl Marx, but it's clear I expect all the gain from any radical shock and revolution in the state, because it itself, in status, can constitute its own community, will never be shaken, but will only benefit from any weakening of everything that is not the Jews. And that's my rough translation here. And he continues in another letter from the same place. He says, I think that this is only the beginning, that the Jews will take over a much larger range of actions in literature, but I don't touch it. The phenomenon of current reality, the Jew is spreading with terrifying speed, but the Jew and his Kahal are the same as a conspiracy against the Russians. That was a letter to Grishchenko, 1878. Now, at this point, especially once the archives were opened in Moscow, you know, this wasn't just the opinion of Russian Orthodox nationalists. The revolutionaries themselves were very clear about what they wanted to do. So Engels, Frederick Engels somehow gets lost in the shuffle, but it's very important to understand him. But what does he say? He says, on the European continent, there are only two forces. On the one hand, Russia and absolutism, and on the other, revolution and democracy. Not a single revolution in Europe and throughout the world will be able to achieve final victory as long as the present Russian state exists. Of course, he's talking about the Russian Orthodox Empire. So once that formidable barrier to revolution is destroyed, Rome is fallen, the end can begin, the rule of demons becomes absolute, and that demand to get rid of Russia continues today. The KGB archives, you know, some of the recent work of Volkogonov, Dmitry, who was part of the parliamentary commissions on Soviet repression, and using some of the newly found records, he states this. He says, from 1929 to 1952, 22 million people were repressed within the USSR. Of these, a third were shot, and the rest sentenced to imprisonment, where many also died. And in Khrushchev's early reign, the de-Stalinization campaign, he came up with the same numbers. And you could ask yourself, what the heck does this have to do with labor? What does this have to do with the proletariat? And the answer is absolutely nothing. You can't listen to their words. You have to see their actions, perceive their actions. That matters a lot more. And it's the dumbest thing for academics to take these people at their word. As if when they talk about, you know, something like prosperity or equality, they're talking about it in the same way that an American would talk about it. Now, Engels says something else in this same vein. This is very typical. The article he wrote is called Democratic Panslavism. And keep in mind that Engels is, like most of the communists, were from the upper classes. And he says, to the sentimental phrases about brotherhood addressed to us on behalf of the most counter-revolutionary nations in Europe, we answer, hatred of the Russians was and continues to be among the Germans their first revolutionary passion. Since the revolution, hatred of the Czechs and Croats has been added to this, and only with the help of the most decisive terrorism against these Slavic people can we, together with Poles and Magyars, protect the revolution from danger. We now know where the enemies of the revolution are concentrated, in Russia and in the Slavic regions of the Austrian Empire. And no phrases or indication that the uncertain democratic future of these countries will prevent us from treating our enemies as such. Then the struggle, a merciless struggle for life and death with the Slavs who betray the revolution, a struggle for destruction and a merciless terrorism, not in the interest of Germany. Now, of course, what he says here is it's not the owners of capital, of which he was one. It's not the monarchy, it's Russia as such and the Russian populations. That's the target here. merciless terror is going to be aimed at them. And there's many other examples of it. He says, in the struggle in Hungary, he says, the very first victorious uprising of the French proletariat, the Austrian, Germans, and Magyars will be freed and will repay the Slavic peoples with bloody revenge. The general war that will then break out will scatter this Slavic Sorbund and wipe even the name of these stubborn little nations from the face of the earth. In the next world war, not only reactionary classes and dynasties, but also entire reactionary peoples will disappear from the face of the earth. And this is what I call progress. Now, of course, we know one thing, is that there were no Magyars in the Hungarian-Soviet takeover. Of course, Engels is writing earlier. But specifically, the communist, briefly ruling communist governments in Hungary and Bavaria after World War I, those two specific examples were 100% Jewish. And I have a paper going through all the names, and Stalin was worried about that, at least for tactical reasons. But understand, this was the founder of so-called scientific communism. This is the agenda. I mean, even during the Crimean War, both Marx and Engels were on the side of Western aggression and demanded the confiscation of all Russia's seaports to strangle her economy. And in my talk and my writings on the Crimean War, go into detail how they both condemned all anti-war movements in Britain. Now, I know not a lot of my listeners know this, but I want to go over it one more time. The main beneficiary of both the white and, but especially the red, February versus October revolutions were the Jews. And that's very easy to demonstrate. The very fact that you can't talk about it in a university is evidence of the power that these people have. And there's so many ways to approach it. Captain Montgomery Schuyler of the U.S. Army, who was there at the time of the revolution, wrote two reports, one from Omsk and the other from Vladivostok. The Omsk, that part of Siberia, he wrote on March 1st, 1918, and he makes it clear, of course the originals exist, that Russian Jews dominate Soviet Marxism. The following year was the second one, and he cited the British journalist Robert Wilton, who was working for the London Times at the time. And that's where the numbers come from. The number of high-ranking commissars in the new USSR, in other words, people with elite status, he named 384. Now that number, more than 300 were Jews. And I say more than because some of the names are iffy. Then he says, by the summer of 1918, the Petrograd Soviet was made up of not quite 300 people, 298 people, and of that, 271 were Jews. And even worse, according to Wilton, 265 of that 271 were brought by Trotsky from Brooklyn, along with his Wall Street money. Wilton's work culminated in The Last Days of the Romanovs, which actually we used to sell at the Barnes Review, which was first published in 1920. And he has actually listings of charts and, you know, names and their positions and for how long and what their ethnicity is. Wilton says this: according to data furnished by the Soviet press, out of 556 important functionaries of the Bolshevik state, in 1918-1919, there were 17 Russians, 2 Ukrainians, 11 Armenians, 35 Latvians, 15 Germans, 1 Hungarian, 10 Georgians, 3 Poles, 3 Finns, 1 Czech, and 457 Jews. So he mentions the Cheka. He says, of the 36 elite leaders of the Cheka by the time of publication in 1920, out of 36, 23 were Jews, 2 Russians total. In the early Soviet Central Executive Committee, Wilton lists 61 members by name. And of that 61, 41 were Jews, only 5 Russians. Calling it the Russian Revolution is the height of illiteracy. And people do it for the same reason they call the Jewish Mafia the Russian Mafia, out of fear of the power that the Jews have. But prior to 1900, no one denied that communism in its various guises in Europe was ethnically Jewish. Early on, between 1900 and 1914, most leftist meetings, not just in Russia, Ukraine, but Central Europe too, were conducted in Yiddish. But once these facts became known, that's where the 10-year sentence for any anti-Semitic statement, anything. And Lenin and Trotsky both, in different times, said because any anti-Jewish thinking is by its very nature anti-Soviet. And throughout the history of the USSR, that law was never repealed. And we all know, we can go on and on. The American ambassador, David Francis, says the exact same thing. Famously, Willem Oudendijk, who was his Dutch counterpart, said the exact same thing. They didn't use numbers, but they said pretty much everyone here knows that this is a Jewish movement. And actually, I took that from a Jewish book, Rappaport's book from 2017. But I do want to switch gears. Revolution isn't merely a socialism or Marxism is a manifestation of the spirit of revolution. Modernity is, by its very structure, a revolutionary ideology. I've spoken of Thomas Hobbes being the real intellectual creator of modernism. And it's been a long time since I mentioned Francis Bacon, who died in 1626, who was a British Lord Chancellor, head of foreign intelligence. He was a scientist, head of the Masonic Lodge of the Rosicrucians, and he should be taken very seriously. And he was very concerned with the world dominance of what was a increasingly revolutionary Great Britain. We talk about the sea power and the land power. Well, Bacon agreed. The navy is central because whoever owns the seas owns the world. It's foreign trade that creates a right to global hegemony. When I was in grad school, I read his utopian work, The New Atlantis, which came out in 1626. I had to skim through it again just to refresh myself before I did this. It's an ideal society created on the island of Ben Salem, of course, Hebraic, where a party, although not a state, is in control of all of social life. The center of this control was the House of Solomon, and it was a secret and secretive society of politicians and scientists. The House of Solomon doesn't just provide the power, the authority of Ben Salem, but also has the idea of permanent revolution because they want to expand throughout the world. And you come across concepts like permanent revolution, multi-party systems, the bright future, the new man, and all of these later on common slogans of the left was part of his scheme. Now, of course, he's writing in a Christian era, and so he's got to make sure that he mentions this. Now, despite this alleged respect for Christ in New Atlantis, Bacon's central core is that only empirical observation can any axiom or any truth come about. Early in the story, the governor says that the canonical books of the Old and New Testaments floated ashore in an ark, and above it was a cross of light. And of course, Christ is nowhere to be found, and this washing up of the Old and New Testament is interpreted by the House of Solomon. The New Atlantis, however, can easily fake these kind of things, and it's stated later in the book. They talk about faking miracles and signs. They probably faked that entire event. House of Solomon is ruled in secret. And a quote directly from the book, it says, the rulers have consultations, which of the inventions and experiences which we have discovered shall be published and which won't be published, and take all an oath of secrecy for the concealing of those which we think fit to keep secret, though some of those we do reveal sometimes to the state and sometimes not. There is a permanent revolution abroad. They have special agents that work under different ideological cloaks, but all have the one goal: the destruction of churches, nations, states, and the transformation of humanity, completely dependent on a single world center of financial and political power. The conquest of the world from Ben Salem, is called The Construction of the Temple of Solomon, in which the ruler of the world, you know, the Jewish Messiah, Antichrist, must sit on his throne. This is where the intellectual foundation of Freemasonry. But of the wise ones who rule the House of Solomon, there's only one member ever mentioned in the book, and he's Jobit, the Jew. The Jewish author Jerry Weinberger makes it clear. He says, because he's the only person, you know, alive at the time that's called a wise one, a ruler, he is the ruler of Ben Salem, which, of course, is a manifestation of Jewish rule over Freemasonry. Baker's New Atlantis was the revolutionary blueprint in literature. Of course, Thomas Hobbes, Leviathan was in philosophy, especially philosophy of science. But this was the foundation of the Rosicrucian Freemasonry, and he was the head of it. Masonic lodges, because of their secret nature, were the breeding grounds for a revolution. They are those who have been enlightened, dedicated to the first revolutionary who ever rebelled, who was Lucifer himself, the bearer of light. Having been cast out of heaven, he continues the war against Christ on earth. And from this, Bacon was one of the founding minds of both English and American Freemasonry, because Bacon was very interested in seeing this possibly come to pass in the Americas. And he was involved in early colonization efforts. But the very structure of Masonry, the revolutionary cellular structure, the use of very abstract and vague concepts of freedom, equality, brotherhood, this is at the core of all revolutionary movements. All revolutionary activity in Russia, starting with people like Radishchev, Novikov, the Decembrists, even Peter I and his friends himself, has Masonic ideological and political roots. There's no getting around it. Peter the Great imported many members of the British Lodge into Russia. Petrograd, St. Petersburg, was built as a Gnostic floating city, the conquest of nature. And all revolutionary organizations in Russia, you know, the Nechevites, Narodnaya Volya, right up to the Bolsheviks, were created on that very same lodge-style model, their main weapons being secrecy, terror, and demagoguery. But Marx saw himself as a successor and the culmination of these revolutionaries. He saw himself as the culmination of the entire Enlightenment. The idea that science should not only describe nature, to discover the laws of nature, but also to change them, that also includes man and society, that derives from Bacon's work. Of course, religion then becomes superfluous, but like you see in Ben Salem, they have to fake it now and again to keep the loyalty of the population. Whether you read Bacon or Marx, Comte, any of these people, science is given the power to be the social engineer of humanity. Truth is not relevant. Bacon was very Machiavellian. Because after all, if science is the only way of understanding the world, and morals and science don't have any meeting point, they are conveniently no moral rules or laws in terms of how science is used. Everyone, I think, who's listening to me right now has read the Communist Manifesto. It's a very good, very brief, very deceptive introduction to the ideology, at least in its exoteric public aspect. The document, though, was a collective effort. The groups that we know about that had a hand in its drafting were the Fraternal Democrats, Society for Human Rights, the Union of the Rejected, and most famously, the Union of the Just, or the Union of Just Men. And I've never mentioned him before, but the ideological and semi-spiritual foundation was Moses Hess. And not just in his Red Catechism for the German people. But Hess makes the argument that the separation of Jews, and hence the rule of atheism in Christian countries, remember, separation meaning he was against assimilation, atheist, materialist socialism is what he considers the final liberation of the Jews. Marx and Hess worked together very often. Eventually, the draft of the Communist Creed was put out by Engels, and then over time it received the name the Manifesto of the Communist Party. But Moses Hess is absolutely essential, talking about the ideological pedigree of Bolshevism. His main work in 1862 is Rome and Jerusalem, and it's a series of letters. And he says this plainly in the third letter. Very few indeed possess the noble spirit which animated the Jewish saints. Most people are anxious to secure as much immortality as possible for themselves and for themselves alone. True it is, at the end of days, when the knowledge of God will fill the earth, is still far off. Yet we firmly believe that the time will come when the Holy Spirit of our nation will become the property of humanity, and the earth will become a grand temple wherein the Spirit of God will dwell. It is true the reign of the Spirit exists already, but only as a germ of spiritual light. To develop this germ to its fullest possibilities, so it will create social values, their labor, along with the Jewish people, the most intellectual, moral, and creative of modern nations, namely, Germany, France, and England. Now, Hess was a convinced atheist. So when he makes reference to God or the Holy Spirit, you can't take him at face value. What he's described here is the social conclusion of the Kabbalah. Hess was a Jewish nationalist and racialist. His socialism didn't have much to do with economics. And this is a clear connection between that pseudo-mysticism and Marx personally. He even talks of the transformation of the whole planet into the Temple of Solomon. And we know this comes directly from the Kabbalah, from the Zohar in particular, because he mentions the separated shards of light that the Jews, and he mentions along with the advanced and progressive left, will bring together in the form of, quote, social value. Becoming the property of humanity. Well, he doesn't say what humanity is. The spirit of the Jewish nation will thus dominate the globe via revolution. But we're talking about Bacon. This is what he says in the 12th letter, almost the end of the book. He says, the civilized nations are at present making preparations for a common exploitation of nature. This will be carried out by means of labor based on scientific principles, all social parasites being excluded. They are preparing themselves for the new era through struggles for free national soil, an attempt to abolishing race and class rule by endeavoring to organize an association and by the cooperation of all forces of production. In this association, the antagonism between capitalist speculation and productive labor, as well as a contrast between philosophic speculation and scientific work, will simultaneously disappear. I know well the need of wholesome and just labor conditions, which should be based solely on the exploitation of nature by man, is also strongly felt in Jewry. This goes far in explaining what Marx believed than taking any of these people at face value. The anti-Christian revolutionary movement divided peoples into backwards and progressives, as Hess mentions. That comes directly from Hess. Marx greeted the origin of the species with admiration. And scientific communism thus received not just an economic, but also a pseudoscientific racial and biological justification. And Marx says, Darwin's book is very important. It forms the basis of my idea of natural selection in the class struggle throughout history. The satanic nature of Leninism, in the sense of the Enlightenment being Luciferian, you know, they weren't subtle about it. You know, the red banner, the pentagram, May 1st as the holiday. This comes straight out of Freemasonry, as did Trotsky. But sometimes I forget, Marx wrote a lot of poetry as a young man. And Satanism is everywhere. And these get ignored. And in these poems, there are calls for revolution against God and the destruction of Europe for the sake of the few. These symbols that I mean, they're all used by anarchists. Bakunin, one of the great founders of anarchism, proclaimed Lucifer, as we all know, as the first revolutionary. And his war against God. Remember, Karl Marx was not an atheist. He hated God. Let me quote something here. In 1837, Marx wrote a poem called The Invocation of One in Despair. The fact that he uses the German for invocation is significant. This is how the poem goes in English. So God has snatched from me all, my all, the curse and rack of destiny. All his worlds are gone beyond recall. Nothing but revenge is left to me. On myself revenge I will proudly wreak. On that being, the enthroned Lord, make my strength a patchwork of what's weak. Leave my better self without reward. I will build my throne on high overhead. Cold, tremendous shall its summit be. For its bulwark, superstitious dread. For its marshal, blackest agony. And the Almighty's lightning shall rebound from that massive iron giant. If he brings my walls and towers down, eternity shall raise them up again, defiant. These verses are the declaration of war against God. The revolution in Marx's mind is motivated by both destruction and revenge. He seems jealous and angry that God exists. But Bakunin, although he, you know, believed the same kind of things, he did attack Marx. And he attacked him for having lived 20 years in London and he hadn't done anything. Of course, what he didn't realize is that the Judeo-Masonic Revolution in England had already ended by the end of the 17th century. And the task of the House of Solomon was not to destroy the Englishman Salem, but to spread its influence to other countries with the aim of destroying the religious and national foundations. And Bakunin, for all of his evil, attacked Marx also for his genocidal hatred of Russians. But most of all, he recognized the utter Jewish control of Marx and Marxism. He refers to his Jewish friends, including Rothschild and the Freemasons. He didn't believe for a minute that Marx was fighting for anything like freedom, equality, or the brotherhood of nations, but a world power of a self-elected caste of conspirators. This pseudo-scientific class struggle and the dictatorship of the proletariat as engines of his ego. Bakunin wrote a letter to the internationals of Bologna. Bakunin accused Marx of being the messiah dictator, power-hungry and doctrinaire, seeking to establish the, quote, socialist and republican world dictatorship, imposing his law, his thought, his movement, his life on the proletarians of all countries reduced to the condition of machines. Bakunin, like many of his ilk, wanted nothing to do with the international. The slander and the persecution never ended. In that same article, he says this: the Jews constitute the real power in Germany. Being a Jew himself, Marx has around him, both in London and in France, many other places, but mainly in Germany, a crowd of Jews who live mainly by his mind and resell his ideas retail. They've taken the possession of the entire press in Germany. For a long time, they have reigned in the world of money and great financial and commercial speculation. With one foot in the bank, these last years have put the other foot in socialism. The entire Jewish world, forming one exploiting sect, a kind of leech people, a voracious collective parasite, organized within itself not only across state boundaries, but even across all differences of political views. This world is at the disposal of Marx on the one hand, Rothschild on the other. I know that the Rothschilds highly value the virtues of the communist Marx, and that in turn the communist Marx feels irresistibly attracted by the instinctive attraction and respectful admiration for the financial talent of the Rothschilds. They are united in Jewish solidarity, a powerful solidarity that's been maintained throughout history. But what can socialism and high banking have in common? Well, the fact is that authoritarian socialism, Marxist communism, desires powerful centralization of the state. And where there is such centralization, there must necessarily be a central bank. And where such a bank exists, Jews can be sure that they will not die from cold and hunger. He hates the idea that, you know, the Jews, as Bakunin argued, are in fact masters of Germany, then their task is to direct Germany against Russia. He didn't care about Russia as such. But this was what Marx was really worried about. According to him, the Jews had long since captured England and the USA. And we know, of course, they defeated Russia with the help of Germany, establishing their power there, and there was a threat of them becoming global rulers. 1903, in London, the Second Congress of the Russian Social Democratic Labor Party. Bolshevism first appeared. They had a secret sect within the RSDLP in 1907 at the Fourth Congress. this secret Bolshevik sect inside that party used revolutionary terror within Russia. And when the war broke out in 1914, it grew into a revolution in Russia, which fully confirmed Engels' idea that the main goal of the revolution was destruction of old Russia as the very last manifestation of the Roman idea, mentioned in various places in the Talmud as the very antithesis of Jewish power. We know it was thanks to the Bolshevik Alexander Parvus, whose real name was Israel Gelfand, and the German Social Democrats, who financed this movement and created the famous SEAL train exported to Russia with the aim of destroying the Russian nation. But the ultimate goal of this vanguard party, for Marx, for Hess, for Lenin, for Engels, was the dictatorship of the proletariat. That was the main method of the revolutionary transformation of the world. And Lenin tried to give this, after Marx and Engels, a scientific appearance. And here's what Lenin says. The scientific concept of dictatorship means nothing more than power that is unrestricted by anything, not constrained by any laws, absolutely not constrained by any rules, and directly based on violence. In the example that we saw, and by the way, that example he's referring to, it was the murder of a political opponent by a crowd right on the street, broad daylight. So he says, in the example we used, we see the dictatorship of the people, because the people, the mass of the population, unformed, accidentally gathered in a given place, themselves and directly act onto the stage as it carries out justice and reprisals and uses power and creates a new revolutionary law. Lenin's definition of the dictatorship of the proletariat and how it's supposed to work is simply a very, very thin veil for the complete arbitrariness and irresponsibility of this Leninist pseudoscience. General Kornilov was not ignorant of this. And he will go so far as to say, August 28th, 1917, he said, "Russian people, our motherland is dying. The hour of her death is near. Forced to speak openly, I, General Kornilov, declare that the provisional government, under pressure from the majority of the Soviets, is acting in full accordance with the plans of the German General Staff simultaneously with the upcoming landing of the enemy forces on the Riga coast, is deliberately killing the army and shaking the country internally. The heavy consciousness of the imminent death of the country commands me in these menacing moments to call on all Russian people to save the dying motherland. Everyone who has a Russian heart beating in their chest, everyone who believes in God and churches pray to the Lord God for the manifestation of the greatest miracle in saving our native land." Now, Kornilov was naive. I've established this in a million places. And he couches his words relative to the needless and senseless Great War. Now, he was correct only in the sense that the Germans were, in, by the way, one of the most short-sighted policies in all history, financing Lenin's movement. And once taking power, one of his very first decisions after October related to the church. He stated very clearly the church was his main enemy. October 26, 1917. I mean, this is his priority. Monastery, church lands, which actually under the synodal period was fairly small, were seized by the state. That very same day, the Bolsheviks shot up a religious procession in Tsarskoe Selo that was praying for peace in Russia. And that was where the priest John Kucharov was killed. Now, the synod, November 2nd of that same year, issued a series of letters and missives, some with St. Tikhon, some without. Many churchmen at this point, though, didn't realize what Bolshevism truly was. And the synod issued, later that month, issued an assessment of the Bolsheviks from a religious point of view. And the synod says a lot of what I've been saying for the last half hour. Let me read part of it. "One part of the army and people, seduced by the promise of all earthly blessings and quick peace, rebelled against another part, and our land was stained with blood. Russian rifles and cannons no longer directed against the enemy, but our own hometowns, not sparing the defenseless population, wives, and children. Instead of a new social structure promised by the false teachers, there's a bloody feud among the builders. Instead of peace and brotherhood of peoples, there's fierce hatred. People who've forgotten God rush at each other like wolves. There's a general darkening of conscience and reason. The sowing of Antichrist has long since penetrated the Russian soul. And the people's heart is being poisoned by teachings that overthrow God and instill envy, greed, and the theft of other people's property. And on this basis, they promise to create universal happiness on earth. For those who see the only basis of their power in the violence of one class over the entire people, the homeland and its shrine of the Kremlin do not exist. The communists, as I wrote in 2019, they used idealistic terminology only as a form of deceit, working class, the proletariat. But for all the crises that were engulfing the old Russian Empire at the time, in 1917, the Bolsheviks increased their seizure of church building. They seized the printing house in January 1918. They confiscated the property of the Alexander Nevsky Monastery. On the 19th, the elderly archpriest Peter Skipetrov was murdered trying to protect the shrine, as was Metropolitan Benjamin of Petrograd. Procopius, local bishop, were arrested. January 19th, 1918, St. Tikhon issued his famous circular, really it's an encyclical, the so-called anathema to the Bolsheviks, and a call to popular resistance. Let me read part of that. The ruling government, which promised to establish law and truth in Russia, to ensure freedom and order, everywhere shows only the most unbridled self-will and complete violence against everyone, and in particular over the Orthodox Church. Where is the limit to this mockery of the Church? How and with what can we stop this attack on her by furious enemies? Come to the defense of our Holy Mother, who is now insulted and oppressed. If it becomes necessary to suffer for the cause of Christ, we call you, beloved children of the Church, to suffer along with us. And that was approved by the Synod on January 20th, 1918. The very next day, the Bolsheviks responded by their decree on the separation of church and state and school from the church. And all that really meant was that church property was declared national property. So even the title of the decree was deceptive. Of course, all property would eventually become national property. You notice with a lot of what St. Tikhon said here, and including his letter addressed to the Bolshevik leadership, you understand that what happened in 1943-1944 with Stalin's Synod was preemptively condemned. He says, when seizing power and calling on the people to trust you, what promises did you make to them, and how did you fulfill them? Truly, you gave him a stone instead of bread and a snake instead of a fish. To a people exhausted by bloody war, you promised to give peace without annexations or indemnities. What conquests could you give up, having led Russia to a shameful treaty, humiliating conditions? You wouldn't even disclose them fully. Our great homeland was conquered, diminished, dismembered. You secretly export to Germany the accumulated gold that was not yours. You've replaced the fatherland with a soulless international, although you yourself know very well that when it comes to defending the fatherland, the proletarians of all countries are its faithful sons, not traitors. You openly replaced the love of Christ with hatred, and instead of peace, you skillfully incited class enmity. And there is no end in sight to the war that you have created. But it's very clear at this point that the Reds had nothing to do with Russia. They're not Russian. And the last thing in the universe they cared about was the proletariat or the peasantry. He says, having seduced the dark and ignorant people with the possibility of easy and unpunished profit, you've clouded their conscience and drowned out the consciences of sin in them. But no matter what names the atrocities are covered up, murder, violence, robbery will always remain grave, crying to heaven for vengeance. Yes, a great good is freedom if it's correctly understood as freedom from evil, which does not constrain others and does not turn into arbitrariness and self-will. But you didn't give that. And every possible indulgence of the base passions of the crowd and the impunity of murders and robberies and the freedom you've granted, all manifestations of both true, civil, and the highest freedom of mankind are suppressed by you mercilessly. And he goes on to condemn the idea that under Bolshevik rule, everything is under the power of the party. Entire households are evicted and property thrown into the street because they've been arbitrarily divided into categories. terms bourgeois and proletariat had no meaning, and that was quite deliberate. Whoever supported the agenda, whoever was an atheist and a Jewish revolutionary, or at least in sympathy with them, was a member of the working class. So when Stalin created the, with the three bishops creating his Moscow Patriarchate during the war, these words had to be repudiated. From then on, if you read the Journal of the Moscow Patriarchate from that era, the administration of this church speaks in the most glowing terms about their jailers and torturers, showing just how far you could rationalize behavior. Now, as you know, I don't condemn these bishops in moral terms, only in terms of their consequences. And I continue to state that most Americans would have done the same, and maybe I would have done the same, and you too, when you're facing life in the gulag or simply being shot, being told that if you don't sign this document, I'm going to kill everyone you know. Most of us would have done the same. We don't know that for certain. But the consequences, however, were horrific. Admiral Kolchak, when he became supreme ruler, took an oath. And he believed that he was going to revive Russia, albeit radically, on a religious foundation. But let me read the oath that he took when he became the chief executive of Russia. I promise and swear before Almighty God, His gospel, the life-giving cross, to be faithful and unfailingly devoted to the Russian state as my fatherland. I promise and swear to serve it according to the duty of the supreme ruler, without wasting anything, without being carried away by kinship, friendship, enmity, or self-interest, remembering only the revival and prosperity of Russia. I will exercise the supreme power received from the Council of Ministers in accordance with the laws until the establishment of a form of government freely expressed by the will of the people. At the conclusion of this oath I've taken, I make the sign of the cross and kiss the gospel and the, of my Savior. Amen. Bishop Sylvester of Omsk became the head of the synod during the Civil War in Western Siberia. And the synod then saw the White Army as a Christ-loving army, led by Kolchak as the God-given ruler. There was another one, synod that met in southern Russia, which backed the volunteer army. Dmitry Bulduriv, who was the head of the Russian Press Bureau under the government of Kolchak, is from Perm, northern Russia, and he wrote an article called The Power of the Cross in the Herald of Siberia newspaper, August of 1919. I'm not going to read it straight out, but he notes that the attacks on churches and monasteries were specifically methodical. They asked for the intimensium. They asked for the holy gifts in order. In other words, there's an instruction manual there somewhere. There's this uniformity of technique. There has to be a central power guiding specifically how to blaspheme churches. And he mentions the so-called autopsies of relics. What the Bolsheviks would do is break into a shrine, open up the reliquary or the casket, and claim that it's all fake, there's nothing here, or whatever. They even had a commission for the opening of relics. This isn't just hooliganism. It's a whole system of Satanism. That's the scale, as he would say in this article, that's the scale of the struggle against Bolshevism. And he says, and I'm quoting here, a flat view of it as a struggle between the proletarians and the bourgeoisie is so naive and primitive that it's unlikely that the leaders of the Bolsheviks themselves take it very seriously. Of course, these weren't random events. It was an organized leftist campaign to destroy the church. So you had revolts amongst the peasantry. You had a civil war raging. You had mass starvation. What's the priority of the Bolsheviks? To destroy the church? To expose the church through relics? Sometimes they would say, it's just a painted dummy in here. This has nothing to do with the working class, because the Reds exploited it and loathed it, worse than any other system that's ever existed. And I have to tell you, and this is the most depressing of all, not a syllable of this was found in the Western media. The Reds themselves were creatures of the Western powers. They were well aware of what would happen. Yes, they used this phony idealistic language, but in many cases they were honest. Breaking Russia and breaking Germany as ethnic units were part of this whole project centered in London. Archbishop Sylvester became a new martyr. Once Omsk in Siberia fell to the Reds, he could have left the city, but he didn't. He was quickly arrested, and he was quite elderly at the time. He was tortured in prison for 2 months. Then he was brought to the Cathedral of the Dormition. He was nailed to the floor and then pierced through a heart with a ramrod, almost like something along the lines of a hot tire iron. And they were doing this as an example for anyone who might defend the church against them. The Cathedral of the Dormition was destroyed by the Bolsheviks, and Bulderev himself was arrested along with Kolchak. And they died in Irtush prison in March of 1920. If you buy my book, A Circle of Betrayal, Cowardice, and Deceit on the 100th Anniversary of the Ritual Murder of the Russian Royal Family, of course, I wrote that in 2018, and I go into some depth about the murder, of course, at the Apatiev house where they were murdered, and there were signs taken from the Kabbalah showing the deeply Jewish nature of this takeover. We talked about, you know, Engels and Marx. They used the word revenge over and over again, and this is what the murder of the royal family was. Clearly, then, the white struggle wasn't just a political military one, but it was a spiritual one. General Kapell said the exact same thing, or Kapell. He says to a group of workers in a Siberian city, and he condemns the Soviets. They go into a village, they empty the prisons, they then form committees out of these people, and these committees then could take whatever they want. And this is what you're fighting against. And they went on to expose the Reds in the same way that St. Tikhon had. The license to steal created this dependent lower class. Every revolution opened the prisons. The left in America wants to do that. You see the attacks on law enforcement, no matter good or bad, making it almost impossible for them to arrest, especially non-white criminals. Even those like General Brusilov, he writes in his memoirs in 1925, he says that this is a worldwide anti-Christian struggle that wants to destroy the light of Christ entirely in the name of darkness. The Bolsheviks found themselves in the company of that great anti-Christian movement that leads them, and they themselves do not know who gives them their directives. One theme that has come up again and again in this last hour, not only, of course, the deception of what this movement was all about, but that Russia was a specifically potent target. And keep in mind, too, that the Western world had a long love affair with the Reds. All of their publications were censored. Nothing about what really was going on there was brought out in public. And you had people like Herbert George Wells, who published the book, The Open Conspiracy, Blueprints for a World Revolution, which was in favor of the Bolsheviks, and that the intellectual elite of the Reds will lead the Soviet Union into the fold of the, quote, Atlantic community, and destined to become masters of the world. And in his book, he talks about a new order established by a select minority, the enlightened ones, and that these will be organized into an order of sorts, in the hands of which will be the entire political, economic, and religious life of peoples, right down to the control of childbirth. And even in Bacon's New Atlantis, there is the murder of the unfit. What has to die is an idea, number one, that Marxism, or really leftism in general, can be taken at their word. In other words, what they claim they want is not really what they want. And number two, that the West was ever anti-communist. That was never the case. the whites did not receive a bullet from the British or the French. In fact, the British, as we spoke of before, destroyed their stores of ammunition rather than either sell it or give it to the whites. The same thing goes for the Americans, who sold it to the Bolsheviks on credit. Anthony Sutton lays this out in great detail, and the regime really doesn't know what to do with them. I mean, in the 1920s, when we're talking about the famine in Russia in the 1920s, President Hoover and the American Relief Association organized a massive airlift of food and clothing. At the same time, the Soviets were exporting wheat to help German revolutionaries. And it was unnoticed because the propaganda was that intense. But the American Relief Association didn't change anything because they realized that you really wouldn't be opposed. American firms in the 30s planned and constructed the largest parts of the five-year plans. President Roosevelt made an agreement with Russia to find, or the Soviet Union, finding that, of course, the Soviets broke every promise they ever made, but that didn't change anything. American assistance and technology and credits continued to flow. And people like Wells discussed his ideas with Lloyd George, Harold Macmillan, Harold Nicholson, just to name a few. And his point of view would become the official ideology of the Western world as World War II dawned. World War II was, not in the Jewish sense, of course, but it was this huge break. World War II and you know, equally World War I, these were the violent revolutionary cataclysms that created the situation that we're in today. There could be no doubt about it. I mean, even Stalin paid tribute to the assistance rendered by the U.S., the Soviet industry. Stalin himself said, and this comes from Avril Harriman during World War II, the U.S. State Department, the telegram of June 30th, 1944. Stalin himself said that two-thirds of all large industrial enterprises in the USSR had been built with American help or technical assistance. And the other third was, of course, built with whether it be German or French or English or whatever. So revolution wasn't just a matter of Bolshevism. Bolshevism was a particularly obnoxious form of it. But of course it exists today. We do not live in a lawless society. It's the same people. It's the same mentality. Without understanding the Jewish element, without understanding the apocalyptic element, you can't understand anything about this. It's not merely a political matter, but it's also a theological one. Thank you, everyone, for listening, and I will talk to you next time. Bye-bye.